Just in case you guys are interested, those of you that were here for the message that I shared about Ellie, the elephant, there is Ellie. And you can see the love in my daughter's eyes for her little Ellie. That was right at the point that my son wanted it really badly. And so she clearly was in love. Speaking of children, you know, it's a funny thing being a dad of four kids now. Have you ever had that experience where you've gotten to a certain place in life and you get to look back on your life and then you see other people in the places that you've been and you just wonder why they're so overwhelmed and why they're complaining so much? Because you're now here, you know? This is what happens with kids. I have four children now. And, you know, I look back every now and then, and I meet a family with one child. You know, they just had their first child, or their child's 2 years old, and, you know, you hear them, and they're like, oh, it's so hard, and I can't control the child. And you look at them and go, what are you talking about? I mean, I dream about having one child. I'm like, can you imagine having one person in the house, and that's it? They can't fight with themselves, can they? Because that's all my children seem to do, is find somebody in the house to have a war with. But you know, when I think back to having one child, I remember when we had Hadley, I remember how it felt to have one child. In many ways, it was harder to have one child than it is to have four children, only because I didn't know any better when I had one child. I wish now I could go back to having one child, because I'd be like, oh, this is wonderful. But back then, you know, you remember if you've had children, you know, the child is fragile. It can break. And you don't know really what you're doing. And every time it cries from anywhere in the house, you come running into the door. Is the child all right? Is the child going to die? I don't know. Now, you know, I put Cole down and he starts screaming and I go, see ya, buddy. 20 minutes. I'll be back. I got three other kids I got to go and take care of. You're secure. You're strapped in. Screaming is good for your lungs, man. So enjoy. You know, because you just kind of get to that point where you just realize when you look back, 20/20 vision, man. I mean, hindsight is always 20/20 vision. When it comes to my children now, the four children I have in my house, it seems to me, and maybe I'm wrong, but it seems to me that we started out with one child, obviously, where everything was quiet except for the child crying and whining. Then we added a child, and it seemed that there was a lot of fighting that would go on as they grew up. Then as we added a third child, the fighting turned into a battle. I mean, it wasn't a fight anymore. You know, now it's all three of them at each other's throats screaming. And I've just added a fourth child, and it seems to me, although I'm imagining things, I'm sure, but it seems to me they've already added him into the battle, and it's kind of turning into a war now. They kind of fight over him now. Who's going to hold him? Who's going to touch him? Who's going to go near him? And I'm just waiting for the day that he emerges out of that baby stage and he can start going gaga, because as soon as he does that, I know he's going to jump right into the war. So as my children fight with each other, I sit and wonder sometimes what it might be like if my children at this age could get the big picture. I mean, wouldn't it be kind of cool if your children got the big picture? They looked at their dad and they just looked at me and went, you know, this man has my best interest at heart. I mean, I just know that. Anything he does or says is for my good. And when he says it or does it, I am going to run with that because I feel good about it. So when I come to dad and say, dad, can I have a snack? And he goes, honey, it's 10 minutes before lunch. We're not giving you a snack right now. Instead of going, but I'm very, 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 very hungry, my daughter will go, thanks, Dad. Gosh, I didn't realize it was lunchtime, and now that you mention it, it is really in my best interest that I wait the 10 minutes and have a good lunch. What about this one? You put the lunch in front of them, and they look down, and the first thing out of their mouths is, I don't like it. And you go, honey, you've never tasted it. It's apple pie. I don't like it. And you put the first bite in their mouth, and they're like, ooh, can I have more? It's like, I mean, is it your job on this planet to just fight me no matter what happens? And it seems to me that that is the case. That is why God placed them on the planet, to fight their way through to adulthood against all of my best judgment, only to figure out when they're 50, maybe dad had some good things going for him. I mean, now that I'm a dad and looking back, I'm like, wow, unbelievable. So, the story we're about to jump into this morning has a lot to do
with this basic principle, because I have to wonder what this planet might look like if we as adults, instead of fighting God all the time, we were able to sit back and go, maybe this guy, maybe he has our best interest at heart. Maybe there's a bigger plan going on here than I am aware of, and maybe I'm part of that plan, and in the end it turns out to be really cool. Can you imagine what it might be like if we as adults got to figure that one out? All right, so you remember our story that we're in. We're traveling through the history of this planet. We start with Adam. He's created in the garden with Eve. They decided to do it their way, despite God's better judgment. God removes them from the freedom and life that they had in the Garden of Eden that he created for them, and they walk into the consequences of doing it their way. And then they have these two boys, Cain and Abel, and we see the consequences of sin even further. Cain kills his brother. And then out of Cain and Abel, we go all the way down humanity, right up to where humanity's so messed up that God goes, you guys are going to self-destruct. So he picks a man called Noah and his family, puts them in a little boat, and humanity self-destructs. God takes care of that problem before humanity takes care of itself. And Noah starts from scratch. Then just a little while after Noah gets back on the planet and gets going, we have humanity building a tower to themselves. Woo, we're so great. Let's do it our way. And the Tower of Babel gets built, and God comes down and goes, they're just going to go straight down the same path again. So once again, I'm going to pull the snack and go, it's going to be lunchtime soon. So he splits them into different languages, and they divide into people groups. Then we find out after they divide into people groups that God goes down and selects a man called Abraham. And he calls him out from these people groups, and he says to him, I'm going to build a great nation out of you, and I'm going to demonstrate my love to this nation, and this nation will know my faithfulness and my promises, and then this nation will become a light to the rest of the world for them to go, wow, I mean, that's an awesome God. And so he starts building into Abraham. Abraham has a son called Isaac. Isaac has two boys, Esau and Jacob. You remember that? So now we're into Esau and Jacob. We're moving through Genesis. We've got Isaac, we've got Esau, we've got Jacob. God splits Esau and Jacob. And in chapter 36 of Genesis, which is where we're jumping in today, we see God closing the book on Esau the way he kind of did on Hagar's son. Remember that? So here we have God going, just real quick before we jump into the story of Jacob, let's take a look at chapter 36 and go through Esau. And he gives us the quick rundown. Here's Esau's entire history real quick. So you can read chapter 36 and you'll figure out Esau is kind of closing out. And then in chapter 37, we jump right into the story of Jacob and his boys. Now, the story of Jacob and his boys is a critical story to everything that's going to develop in the rest of the Old Testament and, frankly, into the New Testament, because Jacob has 12 sons. Now, you remember, Jacob did not have 12 sons with his wonderful wife. It was one of those neat stories where he was given the wrong wife first, so he had a couple sons with her. Then his other wife got jealous and sent the handmaiden, and she had a couple sons. And then the other wife went, wait a second, if my sister's having babies with her maid, then here's my maid. Have some babies with her. And he has some babies with her. And then at the very end, his wife goes, I'm pregnant, and has two kids. And there's the 12, okay? So they're split among the four different women. Don't ask too many questions about that. That is not God's way. Go ahead and read about it. That's where God goes, oh man, what a mess. But thankfully, our God takes the messes we make, and he spins them around into incredible good. So God takes these 12 boys, and guess what happens to these 12 boys? We find out that these 12 boys end up being the pillars of this nation that God is going to create, because they turn into 12 tribes, actually. And the 12 tribes spread themselves out over the next couple of hundred years, and we'll see the story unfold. Today, we focus on one of these 12 boys. His name is Joseph. Okay, so Genesis, in the very end of Genesis here, takes us through the story of Joseph, and it begins by telling us that Joseph was a dreamer. Anybody here meet a dreamer before? My wife will tell you, oh my gosh, somebody help this man, because it's all he seems to ever do. So, you know, in our world today, we have those people. They're kind of the dreamers. And just like in this world where Joseph is, you know, the dreamers are often kind of the weird ones, you know. Everyone else looks at them and goes, what are you talking about, man? I mean, where are you? Hello, planet Earth. You know, that's kind of how we go. We just kind of, woo, let's float. And so Joseph, he's growing up in this world where he's just kind of, he's doing his thing. And then one day God gives him an actual dream. And Joseph has this dream where his brothers come to him and they bow down to him. It's this whole dream about this wheat and the chaff, and they bow down. And so Joseph does whatever any good little brother would do. He runs to his older brothers and goes, guess what? I had a dream. And you guys all bow down to me. It's really awesome. And his big brothers do what any good big brothers do. Let's kill him. Let's kill him now. Before any of the, what is he thinking? I mean, he can't come to 11 big brothers or 10 big brothers and go, I had a dream and you guys are all going to bow down to me. So they decide they're going to kill Joseph. But in the process of killing him, God has a bigger plan, right? So they're about to kill him. And it turns out that this convoy is coming by that has a bunch of slaves. If you've ever seen movies like Gladiator and stuff, you know how that works out. They're just traveling through the kingdom, picking up slaves as they go to head them back to Egypt. Because Egypt needed a workforce, and back in the day, that was the best way to get a workforce, is just go and collect people and bring them in. And so the boys figure out, wait a second, you know what's better than killing him? I mean, if we kill him, what do we get out of it? We get a dead body that we have to deal with, but if we sell him into slavery, he disappears for good, we get some money. This is awesome. What a great deal. So they sell their little brother into slavery. I mean, think about this. I mean, hello? I mean, it's one thing to hit your little brother, but it's another thing to sell him into slavery and send him off to Egypt. So Joseph heads off to Egypt in slavery for doing pretty much nothing other than getting a dream from God and telling his brothers about it. I mean, you got to wonder, traveling in slavery toward Egypt, how the enemy that we talked about, that wonderful enemy that's all about deception, that he wasn't whispering in Joseph's ear. You see what you get for doing it God's way? You idiot. I mean, you see what you get for listening to the dreams God gives you? You're insane. Next time God comes around, you tell him, go away. The last time I listened to you, I got sold into slavery. So Joseph decides not to listen to that, and he heads into slavery. And when he gets to Egypt, he starts doing things God's way. So this guy Potiphar, right, he purchases him, and he gets into Potiphar's house, and as Joseph does it God's way, follows God's command, honors God in everything he does, Potiphar begins to see that Joseph is absolutely trustworthy. So you know what Potiphar does? He goes, Joseph, listen, here's the deal. I need somebody to kind of watch over my house, my stuff. I mean, I'm talking about watch over. I'm talking about it's pretty much your stuff while I'm gone. So I want you to be the man. And Joseph goes, great, awesome. So the Bible tells us that Potiphar pretty much hands over everything to Joseph to be the caretaker of because he's that trustworthy. We have this woman, Potiphar's wife, and Potiphar's wife looks over at Joseph, and Joseph is a young, vibrant man, and her husband travels a lot. You've seen Desperate Housewives. So if you have, by the way, don't watch that show. It's absolutely horrible. I'm telling you, the previews I've seen are terrible. So so here's the deal. So Potiphar looks over at Joseph and goes, you know what? This is an awesome opportunity. Hubby's out of town. Joseph's great. So she goes up to Joseph, and she does what she's probably done with other slaves before, because which slave wouldn't want to sleep with the master's wife? I mean, what a cool opportunity, right? And so she goes to Joseph, and she goes, hey, how about you and me? And Joseph goes, no. And she goes, you know how it works, us human beings, once sin took over, as soon as you say, no, you can't have that, it turns into Ellie. Mine! Mine! So Potiphar's wife goes, Joseph, come on. And she begs him, she pleads with him, and Joseph just keeps going, no, forget it. You don't understand. I don't serve myself. I serve my God who loves me and has a better plan for me than all of this, and I'm going to honor him no matter what. And Potiphar's wife goes, no, you're not. And she grabs him. And you know what he does? The Bible literally says he takes his cloak that he was wearing. And as she's grabbing it, he's like, ah, jumps out of it and takes off. That's where that wonderful part, you know, where Joseph flees from temptation. And we get that, you know, when temptation comes, you run as fast as you can. That's the smart move. You know, strength is not standing against temptation. Strength is running from it. And so Joseph takes off, and you know what? Once again, this young man honors God in everything. I mean, takes a stand, and you know what happens to him? Potiphar's wife goes to Potiphar and says, he tried to sleep with me. He tried to
It was horrible.
And Potiphar goes, what? Dave? No, Joseph? No, that's insane. No, I'm telling you. Look, I even have his coat right here. I always wonder about that moment. Did he rip his coat off and throw it at you? I mean, think about it. But she goes, no, he had his coat and he tried. And so Potiphar goes, that's it. You go to jail. And they come and pick Joseph up and stick him in jail. Okay, let's get this straight, right? First time God gives Joseph a dream. Oh, this is wonderful. Goes and tells his brothers about it, and he gets sold into slavery and carted off to Egypt. And Satan tells him, see what you get for honoring God? And then Joseph goes, no, you're wrong. If I honor God, it'll lead to life and freedom. And so he begins to honor God, and it does. It leads to life and freedom in Potiphar's house. And then once again, this stupid thing happens, and he's sitting in jail. And I can tell you right now, the enemy's sitting there going, life and freedom, yeah? That's awesome. That's brilliant, Joseph. That's brilliant. I mean, this place looks pretty cool. Looks like a lot of life and freedom going on here. You got your friends here who are all here because they killed people. They're fun. And these bars are nice. Yep. I'm sure you feel great about yourself about now. So listen, next time God comes around and starts telling you all sorts of wonderful things, keep your mouth shut and tell him to go away. Because this is what God does to you. God locks you into things. He shuts you down. He keeps you from anything out there in the real world. He keeps you from being free. When you follow him, it leads to this, prison. And so Joseph decides that he's going to ignore that once again. And the Bible tells us that in prison, he starts to live God's way again. He honors God in everything that he does. He does what he needs to do because somehow deep down in his gut, he knows that if he follows God, it leads to life and freedom. And guess what happens in prison? The prison guards start watching him and they're like, you know what? I bet we could tell Joseph to go down to the corner store and bring us something back and he wouldn't run. I mean, they start getting that feeling like you can trust this guy, that his baseline is honor, that he lives by a set of rules we don't understand, that something deep inside him shapes him and molds him and pushes him in a direction we don't get because it stands against humanity. And so they take Joseph and they make him the head of the prison he's a prisoner that's been placed in a place of overseeing prisoners. And so here he is in jail, and I can just see it. I mean, him and the guards hanging out. He's been in prison for a while. As far as prison goes, he had it about as good as you can get, in the sense that he was honoring God, and they started treating him more like one of them than one of the prisoners. And so once again, God whispers to Joseph, if you do it my way, no matter where you find yourself, no matter what circumstances are around you, if you do it my way, it will lead to freedom and life. And so these two guys show up in prison. There were two guys from the king's courts, okay? And a baker and a cupbearer. So they come into prison because in those days with Pharaoh, if you ticked him off, you were either dead or in prison. I mean, it was that simple. And so these guys are in prison and they're sitting with Joseph, and Joseph has comes to them, and there's a dream that takes place, and they, one of them dies and one of them lives. And so Joseph interprets the dream for them because God gave him this gift. So he sits with them and he goes, well, I hate to tell you, but you know, one of you is going to live and one of you is going to die. And this is what the dream says. And they both look at him and go, wow. And he says to the cupbearer, listen, when you get out of here, do me a favor. Remember me, okay? Remember me. And so they leave, and guess what happens? The baker dies, the cupbearer lives. I mean, it's like, that's one of those moments where you go, wait a second, who was that guy in prison? I mean, isn't this exactly what he told us would happen? I should tell someone about that. But who of us ever do that, right? I mean, who of us ever find ourselves looking back? It's not easy as a human being. And so you know what the Bible tells us? 2 years go by. Joseph's sitting rotting in prison. At least he's in charge. And the cupbearer is in the Pharaoh's courts having a blast. And so guess what happens? 2 years later, Pharaoh has a dream. Pharaoh has a dream. And the cupbearer, ding, it snaps. And he's like, wait a second. The last time a dream occurred, somebody interpreted it, came true. Because Pharaoh brings all of his wise men in. Tell me what my dream is. It seems pretty horrible. There are
cows eating things and things, it's horrible. It's a horrible dream. This stuff being eaten and people dying, and nobody can tell him anything. And so the cupbearer comes up to him and says, Pharaoh, just so you know, 2 years ago we had a dream, and it came true because this Joseph guy told us about it. Where's Joseph? Well, he's in prison. He's in prison. Well, somebody go and get him and bring him here. So they bring Joseph to Pharaoh, right? And Joseph gets up in front of Pharaoh, and Pharaoh goes, here's my dream. And Joseph goes, okay. And Pharaoh goes, what does it mean? And Joseph goes, oh, it's not hard. Here's the bottom line is there's going to be a huge famine in the land, all over the land. I mean, a huge famine. And it's what God's doing for you right now is he's giving you prep time because it's going to be years before the famine starts. So if you're smart right now, what you'll do is you will, instead of just eating everything that's out there on the land, you will start putting up warehouses everywhere, and we'll build them, and then we'll fill them with stuff so that when the 7 years come of famine, while everybody else is going, why? You're going, oh, we're fine. We're prepped for 7 years. What an incredible gift that God is giving you. I mean, he's handing you on a platter the future, saying, here it is. This is how it's going to play out. This is what you need to do. And so Pharaoh, being a smart man, he looks at Joseph and he goes, cool. All right, you do it. You take care of it. Start working on this. And Joseph goes from being little brother, telling brothers about dream, to slave, to Potiphar's household slave, to Potiphar's most trusted confidant, to Potiphar throwing me in jail, to sitting in jail, rotting away for years, but becoming the head of the jail. And now, after all this time, he's suddenly standing before Pharaoh. Can you imagine a year and a half into it, after the cupbearer had taken off? Can you imagine the enemy of God sitting in prison with Joseph going, you and me are going to spend a lot of time together. Because I told you when you told your dream to your brothers, that was a bad idea. Look what God did to you for honoring him. And then you go to Potiphar's house and you honor God again. And I told you it was going to lead to disaster. And look what happened. In jail. And then you end up in jail. And I told you, do not honor God. Are you insane? Do you see where this is going? It's a pattern. It's playing out. And then you go and honor God all over again. And yeah, it gets you some leadership in the prison. But come on, who needs leadership in a prison? Freedom is out there. And then you tell me God provides you this cupbearer. Yeah, right. I mean, Joseph, you might be in prison, but let me share with you. It's been a year and a half. Cupbearer is gone. He's sitting in Pharaoh's court enjoying some good wine. You're stuck here in prison. So much for doing it God's way. Good job, buddy. And Joseph sitting there suddenly finds out that he's standing in Pharaoh's court, and the Pharaoh, the ruler of the land, is saying to him, tell me how this is done. And he tells him, and Pharaoh goes, you're in charge now. And Pharaoh creates a world where Joseph ends up being in command, not of Potiphar's house, not of a prison, but of the entire land of Egypt. And he's given the trust of the Pharaoh, who says to him, go, prepare everything. Can you imagine? I mean, can you begin to imagine? Forget being second in command. Imagine the next 7 years as Joseph is preparing and building warehouses and putting stuff away and things are being built up and all this is happening. Can you imagine when the famine hit, who the hero of the land was? I mean, think it through. Everyone knows famine has come. Everyone's dying except for Egypt. And it's all because of Joseph. And so here Joseph is, the hero of the land. And watch this. God is not done with this story yet. You see, I bet as Joseph was sitting on the throne in Egypt, sending his people to do stuff, I bet there was a huge absence there of the enemy of God. Because what does he say now? Joseph, you see, I told you not to honor God. Look what it got you, second in command of Egypt, preparing the land for it. It's ridiculous. I mean, who would want this job?
And here we are sitting and it's preparing and it's all working out. And then watch this. As the lands out there start suffering, people start coming to Egypt. Why? Well, listen, folks, if you were out there in the land and there was a huge drought and everything was dying, I'll tell you exactly what you'd be doing. You'd be heading straight to the place where all the food is. And the food is in Egypt. So what Egypt became is, it didn't just become a place that sustained itself. They had stored so much that they could become a trade center where people could come and they could take food back to all their places. It became a nation that was taking care of the nations. Kind of feels a little like home, doesn't it? You kind of start getting that idea like, wow, we've stored up so much wealth because we've done it God's way that we are now able to do so much for the world. Unbelievable. And so one of the particular families that end up coming to Egypt happened to be related to Joseph. It happens to be his brothers. Guys, remember these guys? Sold him into slavery. Try to kill him. See you later. Years and years and years have gone by. Try to imagine yourself in their position, okay? You're heading out to Egypt. I wonder if on the journey one of them didn't think, I wonder if we'll bump into Joseph. And then the other brother went, are you kidding me? Joseph, he's probably dead. And if he's not dead, if we bump into him, we won't even recognize him. Because he'll walk past you on the street, a slave. I mean, after this many years of slavery, you know what that does to a human being? I'll tell you, our brother, if he's not physically dead, he's probably wasted away into nothing. Don't bother trying to find him. Don't be afraid of bumping into him, because it's not going to happen. So they walk into the courts of Pharaoh, and they go before the great Joseph, the commander of Egypt, and they bow before him. And they come because they need stuff to take home. And Joseph looks out. And with one swoop of his hand, he has them all killed. No, that's not how the story goes. I had some of you there. You were like, what? This is horrible. So, no, he looks at them and he sends them off with supplies and food. He asks about their family, finds out his dad's still alive. And off they go. And you know what happens? As they head back, later on, they come back to Egypt again because they need more, so they come before him again. And this time, they don't bring their dad with them, right? The first time or this time, but you know Joseph, he really wants to see his dad. So he comes and they've got their younger brother, Joseph's younger brother, who was not part of the big conspiracy plan to sell him into slavery. So you know what Joseph does? I mean, it must have been incredible for Joseph. I mean, honestly, as a little brother, I mean, I'd definitely play some games with my brothers. Like, you sold me into slavery, I'm at least going to play some games with you. And so here's what Joseph does. As they're leaving the second time, Joseph takes a silver cup and he has it placed in the backpack of his youngest brother, Benjamin, right? So they're taking off, and as they're heading back to their hometown, the armies come around them and they say, you guys stole a silver cup. And they're all like, no, what, no. We brought stuff. We brought silver. We just need some food. Please, because you know what happens when you steal from Pharaoh or from his second in command? It's real simple. You don't go to prison for stuff like that. Okay, you die. And so now, here they are, and guess what? They open the backpack of Benjamin, and what do they pull out? What silver cup might this be then? I swear I didn't put it in there. I swear it's not my backpack. I don't know where it came from. So they take these guys, they drag them back to Egypt, and they bring them before Joseph. And they bow before him, and the Bible says they lay down on the ground before him, flat, and they're like, please, have mercy. We would never steal from you. We are your slaves forever. Do whatever you want with us. We'll serve you until we die. Go and read it. And you know what he says? He says, nah, that's okay. You guys go on home. I'll just keep Benjamin as my slave. He's the one that stole the cup. I mean, I wonder if Joseph wasn't sitting in the back room with a couple of his confidants going, oh my gosh, they're going to love this, man. I'm going to keep the little brother, send him home to go and tell dad that the little brother got stuck in Egypt as a slave of the Pharaoh. Oh, dad's going to love this one. He's going to kill him. And so he takes Benjamin, and then they go, please, our father is sick and old, and he's going to die soon, and this will break his heart. And so you know what Joseph says? He says, I'll tell you what, bring him here. Have him come beg for his son. When he shows up and comes beg for his son, I'll think about it. And all the time, Joseph's longing in his heart to see his dad. You see what Joseph's up to here? He's not a bad man. He has to get his dad there. He has to see his dad. And so off they go. They grab his dad and they drag him back to Egypt. And his dad comes into Egypt. And then Joseph gets up and goes, "Folks, it's me."
"Who?"
"Joseph, your brother." Has Benjamin been telling you stories? Has he been telling you stories? Because you see, remember when the whole cup thing happened? As Joseph is talking to his brothers, he goes, "Listen, folks, whenever we do terrible things, they always come back around and haunt us. Somehow they always get found out." Brothers are thinking he's talking about the cup, still trying to figure out how the cup got there. But what's Joseph talking about? Selling him into slavery. Bad idea. But God had a plan, right? And so here we come. Family shows up. Dad shows up. Joseph gets up, and he lets them know, "I am your long-lost brother." Can you even imagine the surprise of those brothers going, "What? I mean, we thought you'd, what? How? Tell us the story. Oh, please don't kill us." And so he says, "No, are you kidding me? You're my family. I know you tried to kill me, fair enough, that was a while ago. And yes, you sold me into slavery, but thankfully," this isn't about us, is it? It's about a God who knows what he's doing. A God that despite our sin and horror and terrible things will turn everything around for all of our salvation, including those of us that try to sell their little brother into slavery. Because, watch this, it turns out that Joseph then takes his dad and his brothers and sets them up in Egypt. He sets them up right there. Why go back to the famine land? Come and live here with me. You can have all that I have. And so his dad and his brothers end up living in Egypt with Joseph, and they begin to multiply there. And they have everything they've ever desired. I mean, watch this. God takes a horrible act of his brothers and uses it for the salvation of those same horrible brothers. Isn't that extraordinary? Isn't that amazing? And all this time, the enemy of God was whispering to Joseph, "You're insane to do it God's way. Look around you. Look around and see. People that do it God's way, they're weak. They're pathetic. They need a crutch of some sort. What is this?" A bunch of people buy into that and go, yeah, that's it. That's it. I'm strong enough to do this on my own. I don't need any stupid God. Only problem is that if God is real and he's the creator and he loves us and he's doing all of this, then the same silly principle that started in Genesis chapter 1 and ends in the very end of the Bible is standing right before us again, isn't it? It's standing before us and saying, "Folks, this is so simple. You trust God, you do it his way, you follow his principles, and it will lead to life and freedom despite the journey that you might find yourself on in the process. You do it your way, and it will lead to death." If Joseph had bought into the lie on his way to Egypt, none of this would have happened. If he bought into the lie when he went to prison, none of this would have happened. If he bought into the lie right before he shared the dream, none of this would have happened. But he didn't, and it all happened. And so the salvation of him, his family, and the nation that God is beginning to build is all found in Joseph's obedience, despite the circumstances. See, for you and I, as we stand here, I wonder to myself, what would it be like if I could look back like a parent of four staring into the life of a parent with one? I could stand here with all the prophets that have spoken through the centuries, with all the promises God has made and fulfilled, with the nation of Israel being a demonstration, with Jesus Christ coming to the planet. Remember, Joseph never had, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son that whoever believes in him will have life." Yeah, Joseph never had, "God demonstrates his love to us in this, that he died for us while we were still sinners." Joseph never had Paul writing to the churches going, Consider it pure joy, my brothers, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that it is the testing of your faith that develops perseverance. And when perseverance finishes its work, you will be mature and complete, not lacking anything. Joseph didn't have any of that. We do. We're the parents with four kids going, "Are you kidding me?" It's so much easier now than it was then to understand children and to live with the chaos. Yes, it's harder with four, but somehow easier. Because I've got 20/20, hindsight vision. So as you sit here today, I'll tell you what I challenge myself with as I read this story, and what I challenge you with is this. When you leave here, you want to know what freedom is? I'll tell you what freedom is. That you are part of a much bigger story than yourself. You're part of much more than you. That you are so special to God that He had you born in this time, in this place, for a particular purpose, to unfold in history in wondrous ways, and to have your life be extraordinarily important, no matter how simple it seems. Do you know that when you're going through junk, when people die and stuff happens and you shake your fist at God and go, "Why? Why?" That just like Joseph, God is whispering to you going, "Hold on. Lunch is in 10 minutes. I promise you." And we go, "But I'm very, 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 very hungry." And God goes, "I know you are, but trust me. Trust me. I do not withhold snacks because I'm an evil God. I withhold snacks because I know what is best for you." And when we get everything, when lunch comes, and we go, "I don't like it," God goes, "Eat. Trust me. Because at the end of the day, when it's all said and done, you mark my words, because they're not mine, they're God's. You do it your way, and you will end up in a dark, sad, lonely place. I don't care how good life gets." Because you see, the enemy's always on the same path of vengeance with the same tricks. You ready? If life is horrible for you, if you've lost stuff or you're angry, then the enemy's going, "You see, God doesn't love you. He hates you. He's out for your blood." And when things are going really well and wealth is everywhere and your life is going good and you're on your own, then the enemy comes along and goes, "See, you can do it yourself. You don't need God. You did this. You got yourself here. You can do it." And all the time, those same two people are dying inside. And then there are those who say, "Are you insane, Satan?" One, when bad stuff happens, God has a bigger picture than me at work, and I will be part of it, and it will be extraordinary. And when I've got lots of great things, God has a bigger picture at work, and I'm part of it, and it's going to be extraordinary. So all I get to do is steward the circumstances that come into my life. A ton of stuff or very little. Life or death, it doesn't matter. When it comes, I have the opportunity to go, "God, I don't care that I'm standing in prison and it's dark and smelly. I'll do it your way." Or, "God, I don't care that I'm in Pharaoh's house, sitting on the throne, second in command. I will do it your way. And it will lead to life, not just for me, but for my family, for my friends, and for the nations." And that's our call as the church, to live as ambassadors to the world of God's love, so that He will know that we are out there standing in opposition to the lies of the enemy, like Joseph did, because that will lead to life and freedom. Let's pray. God, I thank you so much for your word. Thank you for this book you gave us, God, with so many amazing stories, so many amazing promises, so many amazing principles. God, I know sometimes when we follow your ways, it certainly feels like we're stuck. God, sometimes when we read your principles, it just certainly feels like there are boundaries in our life that keep us from having the fun we want to have. God, sometimes it even feels like when we honor you most, that you leave us hanging most. God, I can imagine Joseph must have felt that way a lot. But somehow, God, somehow deep down in our gut, we know. We know that if we follow you, it will lead to life and freedom. And I pray for all those sitting in this room right now. I pray for myself, God, that you would burn into my heart that deep knowing that you are at work in my life and that your plan is bigger than me, and that whatever circumstances come, that as I walk through them, if I walk through them following you, I will come out on the other side in life and freedom. But if I don't, I will end up stuck right here. Thank you so much for the 2020 vision you've given us. Thank you that we have so much more to base our faith on than Joseph did. May he be a shining example to us of a man that trusted you despite the circumstances. And may we do the same with all the good and bad that come. And may we never, ever believe those silly lies that you are not there, or that you don't care, or that you're out for blood. May we stand firm. We love you, Jesus. Amen.